Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
Interesting parallels we found when we were writing this book was the notion of a thought experiment, which is one of the, when you have these really difficult questions that sometimes in science there seems to be no way to actually make an experiment to within the sort of current technology to solve it, but you can construct an idea in your head of what it would be. And sometimes the real experiment will come out of that, and that's actually not unlike what the artists are doing at the same time. They're sort of imagining things, creating sort of thought experiments of what it would be like if this was the case. And somehow that sort of sidelong approach to truth is what comes out of these unresolved questions. You can find interesting ways around them, and it's often just a question of waiting to see what will happen when you pose the question.
It is only when we are no longer fearful that we begin to create. The intriguing words of British Romantic landscape painter and watercolourist, Joseph Mallard William Turner. Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. How important is creativity to art, science and religion? Does science make belief in God irrelevant? And will the question last as long as humanity lasts? Well, on tonight's show, we're going to tackle those questions with British artist and painter Roger Wagner and scientist Andrew Briggs, the Professor of Nanomaterials at the Department of Materials at the University of Oxford, whose new book, The Penultimate Curiosity, How Science Swims in the Slipstream of Ultimate Questions, has just been published by Oxford University Press. But first, let's meet one of the world's most famous landscape painters, Joseph Mallard William Turner. In the extraordinary life and momentous times of JMW Turner, BBC Arts producer and writer Franny Moyle writes, "To the Victorians, Turner was an artist who was reclusive, squalid, seedy, and eccentric. He was a gruff and friendly genius who had lost his mind and lost his way. He was a rags-to-riches urchin who had overcome adversity to create a body of work that was largely misunderstood, and yet it had genius at its heart. The Turner myth has proved a distraction from the greater narrative of his 76 years on this planet. Looking back at his full life, one can in fact see Turner not so much a man of his time, but profoundly the product of it." So who was Joseph Mallard William Turner, and what made his art so special?
Hello, my name is Franny Moyle. My career started in television, where I specialised in arts programming. But since 2005, I've also begun to write books about subjects I'm passionate about. My latest book is called The Extraordinary Life and Momentous Times of J.M.W. Turner.
Really well done on the book, Franny. It's a tremendous read. It's hugely interesting and so curious in parts. And I have loved Turner's work, and I felt very up close to him in so many different parts of the book, which is not an easy thing to do. So hats off to you on that one. I might start off with a big, wide open question for you, if that's okay. Are all cultural icons in some way misunderstood, whether it's the likes of Picasso, Beckett, Stravinsky, John Lennon, whoever it is?
I think there are two facets to that question. I mean, one, of course, none of us can ever understand anyone else fully, whether one's a cultural icon or not. We live inside our own worlds and filter things through our own perception. So all we can try and do is get closer, which is something I've tried to do with Turner. I don't think all cultural icons are misunderstood. I think many cultural icons are completely in tune with their times. And, you know, there are terrific examples like David Bowie, for example, who only just died, yet I think all of us feel that his work is enormously pertinent. But I think with Turner, he was misunderstood by his own generation. And I also think he is a little misunderstood by ours. and if you'd like me to expand on that, I think he was misunderstood by his own generation when it came to his late work. Turner was born in 1775, died in 1851, born a Georgian, died a Victorian. And really, the last 20 years of his career, he was producing a kind of work, a kind of painting that a great majority of his audience and the critics was finding very hard to read. I think we find those late paintings very easy to read, and I suspect 21st century people coming to Turner love his late works most, and those are those great, indistinct, some would say near abstract, certainly abstracted canvases, were so loose and fluid in the brushwork, so luminous and sort of misty. And of course, because we've had the Impressionists, because we live in a world where anything goes, it's easy for us to accept those canvases. What I think has happened for us in our infatuation with Turner's late works is we've sort of forgotten that his early career, which was different yet again. And so I think we think of him as this sort of avant-garde pre-impressionist, when in fact he wasn't. I think he was trying to do something quite different and born from a different tradition.
Would it be fair to say that you were trying to rehabilitate his reputation in some way? He's been seen as, you know, clearly an artistic genius, but also as a bit of a madman. So I'm just wondering, were you trying to rescue him in some way?
What I wanted to do was make people aware of the full life. As I say, I think people look at late Turner, and for those who don't know more, and why should they? After all, you know, art history isn't widely taught, it's certainly not going to be taught much longer, apparently, in schools. You know, unless one is very lucky to know the full works and the full life story, it's very easy to think of Turner just in terms of the late works. So I really wanted to show that there was a vast scope of work, that really travels through a life. And rehabilitate, yes, I think he has suffered from a caricature, really. I think, you know, again, a caricature that is sort of pinned on how he was perceived as an old man, grumpy, grunty, eccentric, maybe a bit reclusive. And I really wanted, again, to say, well, you know, that's really just looking through one lens. And actually, if you start at the beginning and look at the life properly, a different man emerges.
He had an unbelievable artistic vision, and it's clear that he was very motivated, very driven. He was obviously quite disciplined. But how would you describe his artistic vision, and within that, how he looked at the world?
Oh, my goodness. Well, it took me nearly 500 pages to do that. So hard to do that in a soundbite. But I think you have to see Turner as a man of his time who saw life as a sort of great journey of inquiry. He was someone endlessly looking to the world around him and exploring it in paint, trying to find answers. And very early on, I think those answers are about being able to correctly depict the movement of clouds or the swell of a sea, or understanding a morning light as opposed to an evening light. But of course, as he matures and becomes a more thoughtful, mature man, actually he begins to explore far greater things: time, legacy, the rise and fall of empires. And, you know, those sensibilities go into the perception of his work as well. Light. You know, so his painting takes on, as it matures, a metaphysical dimension as opposed to a purely scientific and physical dimension that I think you perhaps is restricted to the early works.
Franny, you write very sensitively about his mother, Mary Turner, who was psychologically quite fragile. I know she was in several public asylums all through Turner's life. And it seems that this gave him a degree of embarrassment. And he was also very conscious that he was driving his career. So you say that he'd very kind of secretive and clandestine type relationship with all women as a result, based really on how he had to hide what was going on with his mother in through his public life.
He certainly had a very complicated relationship with women, I think. I think he was very insecure with women. He was a very small guy. You know, he describes himself as a young man, as this little chap. He was small. He wasn't handsome, you know, beady, beaky, bird-like. And I think perhaps because of his mother's illness and perhaps his treatment as a child, who knows, it seems that he was very insecure with women. As a result, he seems to hide away his personal relationships. And certainly, although he's very good at using his male friends for social leverage, you know, he befriends the great and the good, he befriends the great scientists of the day, who are almost all exclusively men, some, of course, women, but what I'm saying is those professional men he doesn't hide from. It's interesting that though he has great friendships with influential and intellectual and society women, he never takes that kind of woman as a lover. He gravitates to a much more simple, uneducated type. And again, I wonder whether that is about, at a domestic level, a sort of lack of confidence, perhaps.
What did you make of his relationship with Hannah Danby? She was his lifelong housekeeper. Certain aspects of it are quite questionable. I know she started in a service when she was just 16 years old and she was with him for nearly 40 years. Mm. But he left her in the dark on lots of things, but clearly had sexual flirtations with her as well.
It seems as if he might have. I mean, there is no question that she was dedicated to him. When he died, she was distraught. The descriptions of his funeral, if you read them in the press of the time, are of his housekeeper bereft by the coffin. And he was particularly generous to her in his will, in as much as he was generous to anyone. So there is no doubt that they had a huge affection for one another and depended on one another. And he writes about her very charmingly in letters to close friends, you know, using sort of affectionate terms. There was a suggestion from his contemporaries that at some stage there was a sexual relationship. I mean, after all, they were living in the same house together all that time. They were only human. It's interesting that when Hannah arrives on the scene, so does another illegitimate daughter. You know, was that actually Hannah's rather than her aunt's? Sarah Danby, who was his mistress at the time, you know, was that one of those sort of family issues that was sort of tidied up by the older woman taking on the responsibility for the baby? I don't know. All this is speculation. But I think what we do tend to do is sort of sanitize the past. It's a bit like we sort of think, well, our parents never had sex, and then, of course, they must have done because we're here. And I think one tends to assume that people of that era were more proper, if you like, or less human than they were, in fact. And if Turner was living with a young girl for all those years in such domestic intimacy, it's not inconceivable that there was a relationship.
Yeah, I found some of the stuff that you wrote about in relation to Sarah Danby, his first or main mistress, let's put it that way, whether he had one or two children with her. And as you said, there's lots of speculation. But I did begin to wonder, as I made my way to the end of the book, did he care for the welfare of his children, Georgina and Alvina, that, you know, his art clearly came first. And then later, when I was reading about Sophia Boot, she was a widow. He met her. She was 20 years his junior and was his last mistress. He was very covert with his friends about her and very patchy in lots of different details. And it did build up a kind of a peculiar picture of him, even though you can understand what he was up to all the same.
Yeah. I mean, he's not a straightforward guy. His work does come first. I think those women were people who were, you know, convenient for him to retire to, if you like. You know, when the day was done, they were people who could offer him comfort and simple pleasures. But he wasn't great at playing a father or a husband figure. He never married. He never officially legitimized the children. He did leave the money in his will at various... He kept changing his will. You know, he did acknowledge their existence, but one certainly doesn't get a sense that they were the sort of the heart of his life. One gets a sense, in contrast, that they were sort of satellites in his life. And certainly Evelina, I think, was left feeling resentful. It's complicated. It's hard to see him sympathetically vis-a-vis his daughters, I think. Having said that, he was clearly devoted to Mrs. Booth, because although she was secreted away, I think that was to do with him needing space from busy work. The Royal Academy, of which he had a very senior position at the time, he was with Mrs. Booth, was an experience he constantly found exhausting and stressful. His clients were demanding. He worked extremely hard. And Mrs. Booth sort of offered him just a release, a getaway. He'd go down to Margate, be by the sea. They would have fish suppers together. He would write poetry about her. And so I think it was not so much that he wasn't prepared to introduce people to her, but that was the whole point. It was to get away from people. You know, his life with her was his private life, which he really did see as distinct from his professional life.
And I imagine also a real break from prudish Victorian society that was so judgmental and restrictive. You write, Turner was not a painter who spent much time depicting sex, but neither was he cosy about it when he did. You write extensively about the erotic drawings that were found, and I know later some of them were suppressed and some of them were also burned by one of his biographers. But I'm just wondering, why do you think all the fuss was made over that?
I think there was a fuss for a very specific reason. After Turner died in 1851, the great critic, John Ruskin, had the job of going through and making the first real proper catalogue of Turner's work and really understanding what had been left in the studio. And it was in about 1856, I think, that Ruskin suddenly came across the drawings. And it was also at that time that a pornography bill had been passed in Parliament. And Ruskin, I think, was quite terrified that the National Gallery, which was at that time the place where Turner's drawings were being held, and his work, of course, was being bequeathed to that institution. I think Ruskin got in a real fret that somehow this great institution might be accused of crimes of pornography for keeping those drawings. So he sort of secreted them away. He sort of wrapped them up in paper, said, keeping just for the purposes of evidence of a decayed mind, I think the phrase was, and sort of bundled them away and sort of hid them and pretended he'd burnt them. I mean, quite a sort of complex story. And I think it was that. I think he really didn't know what to do with them. He felt they were a risk to the reputation of the institution. I also think he was personally horrified by them. I mean, Ruskin, I don't know whether you know the story, but Ruskin and sex is quite a complicated story.
Yeah, he seemed to have quite a difficult first marriage, which wasn't consummated.
Correct.
He definitely was a bit prudish.
Exactly.
But was he maybe very mentally fragile? So as a result, he couldn't deal with anything that went outside.
He couldn't deal with it. And I think for Ruskin, morality and art were bound up with one another. For Ruskin, great art had to be moral. And so much of Turner's works, he saw them as deeply spiritual. And so when he finds, in contrast to these deeply spiritual paintings, you know, these very vivid and suggestive drawings, I think Ruskin is horrified, because in his book those are immoral. So he can't square that circle. Suddenly his hero is not the great moral painter he thought. And the only way he can therefore make sense of it is to argue that Turner was beginning to lose his mind.
It's also a little bit naive when you look at it, because Turner, as you mentioned in the book, did grow up in the red light district, and he was an artist, so he would draw whatever he got his hands on.
Absolutely.
Basically,
I think he was compelled to draw the world around him and fascinated to draw everything. You know, I think he would, anything that suddenly caught his interest, and whether he is drawing for physical reality, you know, the anatomy, the sort of study of movement or whatever reason. I think also we have to remember he was born in the Georgian era, and the Georgian era was really different in terms of its standards of morality than the Victorian era that came immediately afterwards. There were lots of unmarried couples actually living together in the Georgian era. A lot of Turner's friends had, for want of a better word, common law wives who they weren't married to. It was not uncommon. But that climate, that sort of liberal, sexually liberal climate, changed very quickly towards the middle of the 19th century.
I'm just wondering, what did you make of Mike Leigh's Mr. Turner? Did you see it?
Of course I saw it. I mean, it's a hugely important film, and, you know, I'm enormously grateful to Mike Lee and the team, because I think they certainly raised the general public's awareness of Turner, which can only be a good thing for me in my book.
But all this snorting and sniffing and coughing and it was a very kind of dirty, messy portrait of a genius, wasn't it?
I'm less convinced by that. I mean, he was described as a grunter. He definitely was someone who in later life wouldn't stand on ceremony. But I think without a doubt, there was a chatty and a humorous side of Turner that perhaps necessarily didn't come out so fully in that film. I mean, he was a wonderful practical joker. And I think Turner, he liked to be a little obscure in the way he talked, but also he loved clubs and conversation. He did love being part of, you know, groups. So, again, he's a complicated man to pin down.
What did you make of Peter Ackroyd's biography of Turner?
I'll be completely honest, I haven't read it.
Well, there's your answer.
There's sometimes a danger when you write a book, or if I did read it, I read it such a long time ago, I think I probably did read it. But, you know, there's a real danger when you're writing a biography that you don't sort of imbibe the work of other biographers unconsciously. Now, of course, you have got to read some, and of course I did read some of the other biographies of Turner because, you know, I needed to for research. It would have been wrong of me not to, because they're important works. But I didn't read all of them because I needed to find my own path a little bit.
I was looking over some of Turner's paintings this morning, and you, I might compliment you, you have some lovely reproductions in the book. And I was looking at Calais Pier and Wrecker's Coast of Northumberland and Rain, Steam and Speed, which is one of his possibly most famous paintings. Mm. And it got me thinking, what would Turner make of the Turner Prize today coming through the Tate? Because clearly we get great vision and artistry and imagination and originality, but it's all so different.
Well, I think that's an impossible question to answer because, you know, I think the 18th and 19th century art world was so fundamentally different in almost every aspect from our own world, and what, you know, was considered art so different that, you know, honestly, I don't think Turner would be able to understand the art of today. You know, it just comes from a different point of reference. But what he did stand for in his time, and what I think he would appreciate in the prize, was he was always pushing boundaries incredibly fearlessly. He was always, from the beginning, an enormously confident artist, secure in his self-belief as an artist, even if, you know, not confident as a person with women and so on and so forth, or socially. As an artist, he was secure in his confidence. And he was also secure in the belief that British art and British artists must plough their own path in the story of art. They must find their own ways of revealing the truth they sought to reveal on canvas or in stone or whatever medium they worked in. And he, of course, more than anyone in his generation, moved towards a form of art that no one could match. I mean, his art was entirely unique by the end of his career. So I think he would understand the point of a prize that recognized artists ploughing their own furrow and trying to do new work and trying to break boundaries.
Lastly, Franny, does he deserve the title of Britain's greatest painter?
I think it's hard to think of anyone who might deserve it more. He's certainly one of the greatest. I find it very hard to find anyone who comes close to Turner, both in the scope of his work, the quantity and level of output, the huge explorations he made across a lifetime on canvas. And actually, the more I've got to know his work, the more I understand the greatness of him intellectually. I mean, this is not just a representational painter. This is a painter whose work attempts to encompass great, great thoughts about fundamental themes, what it is to be human, what it is to live in time, you know. And Turner really does wrestle with the devil and God on high in a way that few artists do. So I suppose I'm getting towards saying yes.
And that was biographer, writer and TV producer Franny Moyle. The Extraordinary Life and Momentous Times of J.M.W. Turner is published by the Viking Press and retails for just under €25 in all good bookshops. Now, for any of you interested in viewing some of Turner's fine works, well, throughout this month, 31 of Turner's stunning watercolours are on display at the National Gallery of Ireland at Dublin's Merrion Square. And the good news is, admission is free. OK, let's settle into a bit of music, and when we get back, it's the penultimate curiosity with Roger Wagner and Andrew Briggs.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. OK, next up, we're going to unpack some of the big questions in life and hear what an artist and a scientist has to say about the rivalry between science and religion.
I'm Roger Wagner, and I'm an artist and an occasional poet and writer.
I'm Andrew Briggs. I'm a scientist, and I have the chair in nanomaterials at the University of Oxford. Nanomaterials really just means small stuff.
Well, the book is certainly not about small stuff, to say the least. Congratulations, Andrew and Roger. It's a smashing read, and to use a term that you use in your title, it's hugely curious. I might just start off with a big, broad, wide-open question for you. And Andrew, I'm going to throw to you to kick things off. It's a quote from the Greek philosopher Aristotle. Aristotle once said that I would rather have a mind opened by wonder than one closed by belief.
Well, Aristotle is one of the people that we write about in the book because he's one of the people who illustrates the theme of the book, which is that where you have a culture or a community or even just an individual who's interested in the really big questions, questions about meaning and purpose and love and how God can be known, time and again, in that sort of culture, you get a curiosity about the material world that led to the kind of way of thinking that we would now describe as science. And Aristotle was undoubtedly one such. He thought about big questions, ultimate questions, and he wrote an awful lot about what we now call physics and the physical and the material world. But I think that particular quote you have is probably a false choice between wonder and belief, because actually all of wonder starts with belief. So when you're amazed at something, you think it's really wonderful, there are always some beliefs and presuppositions that lie behind that, and they could be false beliefs, and time and again they are true beliefs, or more likely they're beliefs that are subject to being updated and refined in the light of the very things that you're wondering about and the very things that you might be curious about. And so this sense of awe and wonder, I think, starts with belief, but it also leads to belief. So it's a wonderful fuel for belief. So as one finds things around, facts, observations, things you look at, things you can hold, that are really amazing and evoke in you this sense of wonder. So I think that leads to a refinement of beliefs, maybe a correction of beliefs. So really I think the two go much more closely together. They're more like a sort of left foot and a right foot that you walk on.
But why do you think it is that scientists and religious thinkers are kind of pitted against each other in some way? And that in a lot of ways, religion is seen as an enemy to a degree of the progresses that can be made in science. Why do you think that is?
Well, it's all great stuff, isn't it? You know, we love a disagreement and an argument much more than we love hearing about people who are getting on together. So it's perfectly true that there are some scientists who, for whatever reason, reject God. And it's also true that there are some members of religious organizations who reject aspects of science. I suppose often the discussion is around the theory of evolution. But particularly in the UK, actually, particularly in England, we have a very, very strong tradition of absolutely top quality, very distinguished research scientists who've got a strong faith in God, you know, who've thought through very carefully how their science relates to that. And it has to be said also that we've got a very strong tradition of senior church leaders who've made themselves quite knowledgeable about the science, actually, and as religious leaders have embraced science too. There's a much stronger story of the engagement between the two than is widely told. And one of the things that we hope we do in the penultimate curiosity is actually to show that there have been lots and lots of cases like that. And they've happened not only in England, but throughout the educated and curious world.
Roger, you write curiosity at some level is as old as life itself. I'm just wondering, does all art start with a question?
That's a very interesting question itself. Whether it starts with a question, I suppose it certainly does start with a curiosity about what is surrounding you. I mean, as Andrew was sort of saying, one of the things that certainly got me into sort of thinking about this story was actually seeing how far back that kind of curiosity goes in the sort of human story. So that when we first sort of started thinking about this book, was way back in sort of 1994, it was just when the Chauvet Caves had been discovered in the south of France, which they found these amazing paintings, which were not only far, far older than anything that had ever been seen before. They were about sort of 35,000 years old. But they were also, in terms of some of the drawings, they were far more anatomically accurate than any cave paintings that had previously been seen. It made me think that what was quite clear, and I think virtually all the scientists who look at these images now agree on this, is that the fundamental impulse, because these things are done deep underground and they aren't places where people live. They were done, as far as we can see, for religious kind of motives. And yet this somehow impelled people to start looking at the animals they were drawing much more, very, very closely, and actually looking at their anatomy and working out how they moved. So to write back in the human story, you get these two things in a very interesting way working together.
It's remarkable when you think about it, but in ways it makes sense, because presumably to have breath is to question the world around you. And whether it was those who were painting caves or, you know, Renaissance frescoes or the like, that's what it's about, isn't it, really?
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And also, it's not just sort of that we're interested, but we're trying to make sense of the, you know, what we're doing here, because that kind of internal motivation seems to be something that, again, goes back very, very far into the human story, and is something we can all relate to at the same time, because we know that life isn't just about, you know, sort of eating and drinking and making money. It's something we need somehow to make sense of the world and to find a place in it. And that seems to be a sort of permanent aspect of the human condition.
Andrew, you quote some extraordinary minds throughout the book, unbelievable scientists, philosophers and broad-based thinkers. You have the likes of Darwin, we've got Newton, you've got the great Pascal. There was a quote in the book that particularly appealed to me, and it was from the 17th century German mathematician and astronomer Johannes Kepler, who famously declared that we should regard the Holy Spirit as a divine messenger and refrain from dragging him into the physics class. As a nanotechnologist, what do you make of all of that?
Well, Johannes Kepler was a brilliant observationist. Not only the observations that he made, but the mathematical connections that he made between them were crucial to Isaac Newton's subsequent developments of the laws of motion and the understanding of how planets move around the Earth and so on. And one of the sayings that he's famous for is describing his own work as thinking God's thoughts after him. So I think what Kepler's approach was this, that it's hard work doing the kind of astronomy that he did. It needed a great deal of thought, a great deal of imagination, certainly a great deal of curiosity. It must have been, I think, hugely satisfying for him when he found these very elegant mathematical relationships between his observations. And what he's saying is, wow, you know, I've discovered this, and I know who was responsible for it all. He was describing his relationship with God. And he was saying, I thought of this now, but God thought of it first. And I've worked out how it is that God thought it should go together. And I think he must have found that hugely exciting.
The title of your book is it's hugely intriguing, and I suppose it really hammers home your argument, The Penultimate Curiosity, How Science Swims in the Slipstream of Ultimate Questions. I'm just wondering, for a scientist as distinct from a theologian or as an artist, Roger, can we actually say there are so many different ultimate questions, or is it for you that the ultimate question is that there is or not a God?
I think ultimate questions certainly include that idea. But we can also, you know, just know from our own lives that the question about God is one question, but it's related to all kinds of other questions about value, about morality, which are questions that you can't answer in a laboratory, but actually deeply affect what you're doing in the laboratory. And perhaps Andrew would want to comment on that.
As a professor, you know, one of one's most important responsibilities at a university like Oxford is to help the next generation work out what question to ask. And you want to try to find questions that are important and where there is a hope of making progress in them. Now, you mentioned the question, is there a God? That's actually not a terribly, in my observation, terribly fruitful question, because people argue and argue about it and they don't make very much progress on that. And it seems to me that much more fruitful questions are questions like, what is God like? And can he be known? These questions do seem to me to lead to fruitful discussion and fruitful progress.
Well, do you think through science that we have got any way closer to God? Let me put it that way.
Well, that depends, all right? That sounds like an academic answer, but let me tell you what I mean by it. For those who already know God and who already have a relationship with him, science gives a fabulous opportunity to learn more about his creation, as Kepler said, to think God's thoughts after him, and to learn more about him. For someone who doesn't know God, I can quite understand that that might leave them all cold. If they haven't already got the relationship, they may not be able to see the connection. And, you know, it may be like trying to play your favorite music to someone who just doesn't appreciate it. And I think there are plenty of people who, for whatever reason, have decided not to believe in God, who don't find any sort of evidence in their science that would incline them towards faith or would bring them closer to God.
Andrew, I'm just wondering, you reference the French polymath Blaise Pascal. One of the things he said, it's not just curious, it's very hard to fully understand what he means by it. And I'm wondering maybe if you could offer some insights into it. He said, if there is a God, he's infinitely beyond our comprehension, and that reason cannot decide anything. There is an infinite chaos separating us. What do you think he meant by that infinite chaos? And how maybe does a scientist understand infinite chaos as distinct from an artist or a theologian?
Well, let me give an artist answer before Andrew comes in with the scientist. I think that one of the things that that makes Pascal such an interesting, and in some ways he's one of the sort of heroes of the book, because when you were quoting the from Kepler before and saying that about not dragging the Holy Spirit into the schoolroom, I think what Kepler was reacting against was the idea that you can actually solve scientific questions by looking at what it says in the Bible, because his idea was that actually wasn't what the Bible was intended for. The Bible was trying to open up sort of spiritual questions and wasn't in answering those kinds of questions, that it could inspire them. And one of the reasons we called the book The Penultimate Curiosity was our sense that though the sort of scientific questions can be motivated by these sort of big sort of ultimate questions, there needs to be a kind of distance between them, because it's very tempting to sort of grab hold of the science and say this actually proves there's a God or proves there isn't a God. And what Pascal was very clear about was that actually we just don't have the kind of information that it's not possible for a part, as he put it, to be able to know the whole. So that if you're looking to your science to give you these kind of answers, you're looking in the wrong place. You're not going to find them there. And quite a lot of the one of the metaphors we use in the book is this idea of a sort of slipstream, that sort of often scientific questions operate rather like a sort of bicyclist going along in a peloton, or sort of birds in a V formation, that they can move along behind in the slipstream. But often what happens in the Tour de France or something is when the wheels get too close, there's a great sort of shoot, as they call it, a clash, everyone falls over. And it can happen. And obviously there are historic instances of this with sort of Galileo, with Darwin and so on, of people trying to use science or and religion to sort of answer each other's questions. And you need to keep a distance. You need to realise the limitations of the human mind.
Roger, the likes of Sam Harris or Richard Dawkins would maybe take slight umbrage to the fact that you would consider that they're swimming in, to use the title of the book again, the slipstream of ultimate questions. They would argue that we don't need God to ask our ultimate questions, and bringing God into things doesn't actually bring us any closer to answering those ultimate questions.
Yeah, the interesting thing about that is that, I mean, ultimate questions aren't simply sort of religious questions. You can actually, atheism is very much an ultimate question. It's trying to sort of look at not just at what you can find in a laboratory, but it's actually trying to ask sort of big metaphysical questions. And it's interesting that certainly some of the we talk about Francis Crick, who one of the discoverers of DNA, who he said very clearly that a lot of his scientific motivation was trying to prove that religion was wrong.
Yes.
Which you could call, that is an ultimate question.
You know, when we talk about this curiosity, we don't want to impose on anybody else what their ultimate question should be. You know, we'd love to encourage people to be curious about the things that they're curious about. So everybody chooses what they're going to be curious about, and I think that's part of what it means to be human. One of Pascal's successors in probability theory was Thomas Bayes. Like Pascal, Thomas Bayes believed in God. In fact, he was a clergyman. He developed a very important branch of probability called conditional probability, and what he showed in a very rigorous mathematical way was that if you get some new data, then the new belief that you rationally come to depends not only on the data, but also on what your prior belief was. So if you have a prior belief that you've chosen to reject God, and then you get new data, which might be scientific data, then the conclusion you now come to, the belief you now come to, may be very different from what would happen if your prior belief was that you do know God, and then you get the scientific data. It happens that Richard Dawkins is a neighbor. I regularly cycle past his house on my way into the lab. And he has chosen, at least in public, whatever his private beliefs are, to reject God. And therefore, when he gets new data, new scientific data, he will interpret that in the light of his prior beliefs. And therefore, it would be rather surprising if, given those prior beliefs, he looked at the scientific evidence and came to a belief in God, which, as far as we know, at least in terms of his public writing, has not happened.
Roger, I'm just wondering, how does contemporary Christian art make us understand or help us understand in some way our world, our very, very complex world? Do you think it can allow us to understand it any better than we're already doing by maybe spending time with Christian art?
Yeah, that's, again, a very interesting question. There are kind of different sorts of understanding. And the kind of understanding that art gives you is actually very difficult to sometimes express in words. It's very different from the sort of scientific understanding. It's often more emotional, it's more imaginative, and yet it is deeply important to, I would think, almost to all of us in some kinds of ways. Some people are obviously more responsive to certain kinds of art to certain kinds of beauty than others. But I think it's a sort of deep need within everyone. And we certainly look to the art of the past, and that's a sort of constant source of refreshment. But I think we also need the art of our own day to, as you say, to understand things that are going on at the moment, and are often just to sort of process things that are going on at the moment.
Andrew, last question. Do you think by holding on to the tensions and possible contradictions between science and religion, that it can be a force of good in some way, that those tensions can generate positive results and
be
yes, productive?
I love hard problems. I thrive on them. That's what we love to identify in my laboratory, difficult things that we don't understand at the moment, but that we'd like to understand better. And we love identifying what those are and thinking of new experiments or calculations or perhaps creating new concepts that will help us to make progress with these hard problems. Just to give you an example from my laboratory and then show how it could apply to the life of faith. In my laboratory, one of the things we do is we develop quantum technologies. And rather amazingly, there is no agreement amongst scientists about what happens when we measure a quantum system. So you'd think that measurement is one of the most basic things you can do in a laboratory, which indeed it is, but there's no consensus about what it means to measure a quantum system. So we have to live with that, as it were, unresolved question without losing interest in trying to understand it better. And indeed, we've done some experiments in my lab that will help to rule in or rule out certain interpretations. And in a similar way, in the life of faith, in our relationship with God, there are some really hard questions. What happens when we pray? How does God act in the world? And just as the quantum experiments that we do in the lab are too important and too robust to abandon them until we've got satisfactory answers to all the relevant questions, so too the life of faith is too important and too robust to put on one side. And I think that the life of faith can learn from the life of science about how to live with these hard questions and retain a passion for trying to understand them better, but without stopping the practice.
And one of the sort of interesting parallels we found when we were writing this book was the notion of a sort of thought experiment, which is one of the when you have these really difficult questions that sometimes in sort of science there seems to be no way to actually make an experiment to, within the sort of current technology to solve it, but you can construct an idea in your head of what it would be, and sometimes the real experiment will come out of that. And that's actually not unlike what the artists are doing at the same time. They're sort of imagining things, creating sort of thought experiments of what it would be like if this was the case. And somehow that sort of sidelong approach to truth is what comes out of these unresolved questions. You can find interesting ways around them, and it's often just a question of waiting to see what will happen when you pose the question.
Was British artist Roger Wagner and nanotechnologist Andrew Briggs. Their penultimate curiosity, How Science Swims in the Slipstream of Ultimate Questions, is published by Oxford University Press and retails for just under €28 in hardback. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. All that's left for me to do now is to say a big thank you to Ronan Brannock, who helped out with this week's programme, and the lovely Lee Duncan on sound. We've been Talking Books. I'd like to end tonight's broadcast with some constructive and illuminating words from Joseph Mallard William Turner. My job is to paint what I see, not what I know. Good night.